court before it, human activities. Okay. So, one should regulate his sense gratification by a balanced program of spiritual and material knowledge. The activities for the maintenance of the body should not be stopped, since the culture of spiritual knowledge necessitates the help of the body and mind. Their maintenance is required. But these activities must be performed in connection with the ultimate goal of going back to Godhead. Srila Prabhupada concludes, quote, human activities diseased by a tendency towards sense gratification have been regulated in the Vedas under the principles of salvation. This system employs religion, economic development, sense gratification, and salvation. But at the present moment, people have no interest in religion or salvation. They have only one aim in life, sense gratification. And in order to achieve this, they make plans for economic development. Misguided men think that religion should be maintained because it contributes to economic development, which is required for sense gratification. Thus, in order to guarantee further sense gratification after death, in heaven there is some system of religious observance. But this is not the purpose of religion. The path of religion is actually meant for self-realization, and economic development is required just to maintain the body in a sound, healthy condition. A man should lead a healthy life with a sound mind just to realize vidya, true knowledge, which is the aim of human life. This life is not meant for working like an ass or for culturing avidya, for sense gratification. Unless religion, economic development, and sense gratification aim towards the attainment of devotional service to the Lord, they are all simply different forms of nescience, as Sri Ashupanishad indicates in the following mantras. So here again, this point of that the Dharma, Artha, and Kama and Moksha should be used for development of devotion. Means you have to use something. Means devotion is a process. Process means activity. That means unless you're doing an activity, how is it going to be devotional service? Right? We just don't sit down and you know, meditate on nothing. You know, just exist. That's not devotional service. Devotional service means something active is happening. So for that activity to happen, then you're going to use your senses, right? All activities, basically, you're dealing with the senses. And so then to work with those senses, then you have to, they actually have to function. So that means then you would need the artha, or the health to maintain that. Then the Dharma will give that as a side thing. But the purpose of Dharma is to connect oneself to the Lord. Right? You're not trying to develop artha for yourself. You're trying to develop pleasure for the Lord. So here is saying the tendency for sense gratification has been regulated in the Vedas under the principles of salvation. So that means the regulation, see, we take it that regulation of sense gratification, then it's just is religion. But actually, it's meant for the purpose of salvation. Because only in a regulated lifestyle can you then distinguish between what should be done and not done, and what is the quality of what you're dealing with. Otherwise, how do you tell the difference between rasas? Unless there's some regulation. Right? So the more the regulation, then the better the example. I mean, the better the results. Like, let's say you have these contests where they're working on taste of something, right? You know, they're having people, the ladies are baking pies, or you know, they're tasting different things, or smelling different things. But there's rules on that. They just don't walk in and start tasting everything. They can't have eaten. You know, after they taste one thing, then they have to rinse their mouth, and there's a whole regulation. Otherwise, even the understanding and being able to discriminate the senses doesn't work very well. So the whole idea is by regulation, then you bring the intelligence into the picture. When you bring the intelligence into the picture, then you can discriminate. Otherwise, you can't tell the difference, actually, between Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha, and Bhakti. Like that. Many can't. You know, if it's just something religion, then it's Bhakti. Oh, Bhakti for my family, Bhakti for my children, Bhakti for the devas. They'll say that, devotion, but it's not actually devotion. Bhakti is only in relationship to Krishna. Right? Krishna and Krishna's pure devotees. That's bhakti. But everything else, it's actually you're doing it for your own purposes. It may be more subtle, maybe more elevated. You know, instead of gross sense gratification, it's extended sense gratification. You're not worried about your senses, you're worried about someone else's senses, but it's still sense gratification. That's why he can say religion and sense gratification. Artha is just what maintains that sense gratification, because it maintains yours and others. So that's the difference. Pranamoy means maintaining others' sense gratification. Therefore, you need economic development, you need social systems, you know, rules of ethics, you need judicial systems for those who don't follow the ethics, right? Because all those things will get in the way of sense gratification. That's their point. Money is there for sense gratification. Justice is there for sense gratification. Ethics is there for sense gratification. Right? Religion is not meant for sense gratification. That's meant for sacrifice. But these things aren't connected. So those who understand Dharma, Artha, and Kama in connection with the Lord, and Moksha in connection with the Lord, they actually can come to the devotional platform. So mantra 12. Okay. Mantras 9 and 12 describe people bereft of Ishvara consciousness. In mantra 9 it is said that both the ignorant and the educated materialists are doomed, and among them the atheistic intellectuals are worse. They're doomed and then there's worse. Right. Mantra 12 states that the Mayavadis go in deeper darkness compared to the demigod worshippers. Because the demigod worshippers, at least you're dealing with the concept that there are people involved in relationships. Well, the impersonalist gets rid of all idea of form and interaction and anything. So that's real ignorance. Even though they're so intellectual, but actually they're the most ignorant, because spiritual life is interaction. You have senses, you have emotions, you have form, you have activity. But it's transcendental. Well, in the material world, you have the same activities, but they're misdirected. So the problem is not the activities, it's the misdirection. That's the problem. But so the impersonalists, then they're actually the Mayavadis here, not specifically the impersonalists. The Mayavadis, they're even more in ignorance, because they say there is nothing. Which is not the fact. There is something. There always is something. There always was something. Right? Does that make sense? So that's why they're in deeper darkness, even though they claim that they are more elevated, because they're intellectual. Like that. But here it shows that how they're not necessarily. The worship of the demigods brings merely partial and temporary relief from the miseries of the material existence. Therefore, Sri Upanishad advises that only the Supreme Personality of Godhead should be worshipped, since only this type of worship can bring the ultimate good for the soul. It is not possible to understand the Absolute Person simply by negating the material qualities. It's not possible to understand the Absolute Person simply by negating the material qualities. Thus, although posing as high-grade transcendentalists, the Mayavadis actually support the cause of the atheists. Quote, the atheist directly denies the existence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the impersonalists support the atheists by stressing the impersonal aspect of the Supreme Lord. Shusha Upanishad Mantra 12 Purport. An example of how the Mayavadis support the atheists is given by Srila Prabhupada in his purport to Srimad Bhagavatam 111. Quote, the whole material creation is moving under the principle of sex life. In modern civilization, sex life is the focal point for all activities. Therefore, Wherever one turns his face, he sees sex life predominant. Therefore, sex life is not unreal. Its reality is experienced in the spiritual world. The material sex life is but a perverted reflection of the original fact. The original fact is in the absolute truth, and thus the absolute truth cannot be impersonal. It is not possible that you be impersonal and contain pure sex life. Consequently, the impersonalist philosophers have given indirect impetus to the abominable mundane sex life because they have overstressed the impersonality of the ultimate truth. Consequently, man without information of the actual spiritual form of sex has accepted perverted material sex as the all in all. Right? You understand this? Because people are interested in material sense gratification. So then that means you're going to have to engage your senses. So if the Lord is impersonal, that means there is no way to engage your senses in connection with the Lord. So there's no spiritual application of sense gratification. Right? So then that would mean that if it's not, since the living entity is going to engage in sense gratification anyway, then he's going to do it without connection to the Lord. Right? Because if there's some connection to the Lord, then the tendency is to control it, to regulate it, as we saw before. Is by regulating it, then that brings around the element of liberation. Right? So without this regulation, then there's going to be a problem. Right? So now, why would one regulate unless it was for a higher purpose? Right? So unless you're convinced that by regulating you're going to get more sense gratification, who's going to do it? Like someone might regulate here because they want sense gratification in the heavenly planets. Right? You know, what is it? You know, So the difficulty then comes is that if one acknowledges that there is sensual activity in the Supreme, but that sensual activity is on the transcendental platform, then one can be inspired to bring one's senses in line with that application of the senses. So that will regulate, that will improve, that will uplift. But if one doesn't, then since the living entity is going to have to engage the senses anyway, since the Mayavad concept is bogus, it doesn't exist in reality, the living entities, therefore, they're encouraging sense gratification, even though they claim they don't engage the senses. Right? But they're actually encouraging it. Because people are going to, if there's no supreme, then basically it comes down to sense gratification is just whatever you feel is important, rather than what the Shastras say is important. Does that make sense? And even if you accept the Shastra because you're pious, you're going to do it simply because that's the best way to get sense gratification. You're not doing it because it pleases the Lord. So therefore, the element of liberation actually never really comes up. Right? Very rare you find a person can follow the Shastra in the platform of Naishkarmya and not be a devotee. In previous ages, they could do it very nicely. Right? But in this age, it doesn't basically really work. Does that sound like something? The impersonal conception of the Supreme Lord is a form of ignorance, arising from an imperfect concept of the Absolute Truth. The Mayavadis who deceive their followers with concocted ideas must go to the darkest regions of the universe. Quote, "These rogues are the most dangerous elements in human society. Because there is no religious government, they escape punishment by the law of the state. They cannot, however, escape the law of the Supreme, who has clearly declared in the Bhagavad Gita that envious demons in the garb of religious propagandists shall be thrown into the darkest regions of hell." Bhagavad Gita 16:9-20, Ishupanishad purport 12, verse 12. Okay, so basically speaking, is because we're dealing here with this Ishavasya principle, And everything's connected to the Lord, so that includes the senses. That includes all form, all social elements, right? All social interaction, all elements of emotion, need. So if it's seen that that's there in the transcendental platform, then one tries to, and that is the proper situation for the living entity. The natural situation, but it's very unnatural for this living entity to be entangled here and engaging separate from the Lord in material activities. So the idea is then how to bring oneself to the point of giving up the material activities here and taking up the spiritual activities. Right? So you're giving up material sense gratification, taking up spiritual, giving up material emotion, taking up spiritual. So that is then what is being pointed out. So those persons who say that we just get rid of the senses and emotions, then they're most dangerous, right? But because today the government's not religious, therefore they don't take this as bad, as an offense. Like that, but otherwise it should be punishable, right? The Brahmins have to be espousing things properly according to Shastra. If it's not according to Shastra, it shouldn't be done. Therefore, it should be that the government is seeing that improper understandings of the Shastra are not being allowed, right? Like that. So that's why Prabhupada, means based on this principle, that's why Prabhupada says philosophical deviation is worse than sensual deviation. Because philosophical deviation means then you don't actually accept the spiritual. So it's not progressive. You're not going to go back to Godhead. Right?
Since there is this tendency of yatamatatapat, there's going to be a whole lot of argument and a whole lot of debate and a whole lot of judgment calls. So is that an ongoing, a regular affair in a state or in a kingdom?
Oh, would it be regular?
Or is that just in the modern times that people are so absorbed? I mean, even then they were absorbed in arguments and schools of thoughts. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. Was it accepted that, okay, you have this school of thought, you have this school of thought, as long as you follow your school, then that's fine. So you're just supposed to follow whichever flag you're under, or
basically you would have that would be your most general, but you would also have those who would take kings that would take an active part to establish appropriate behavior. I think it's just like in South, what was it, in Humpy and that, they had to be Vaishnavas, or here in Bengal, in Vishnupur. The king there, then, it was, they had to be Vaishnavas. You were Shaivites or other things, then you had to leave, you know. So it's just, so Vishnupur was just devotees, like that. So you would have, but the main thing, it had to be correct according to Shastra. So even if you were a Karmakandi or Jnanakandi and that, you had to be practicing properly. Just like if you're a Brahmin, you know, any of the four Varnas or Ashrams, if you were practicing it properly, then that was okay. If you were not, then that would be corrected. You know, you had to be situated in these. Unless you were a Paramahamsa, then that's very obvious. But it was the government's business to see that, you know, the proper environment was there. So the more the realization of the king, then the more he would, it would influence the people. But as we see in some of them, they didn't have to. It means because the kings were following, Brahmins were following, then the citizens would follow. You see, like during Shantanu's reign, it was very, very nice. Everybody was just following. And sometimes, like after Parasaram killed all the Kshatriyas, then the Kshatriya women, they went to the Brahmins, the, you know, elevated Brahmins, and then through Niyoga, then they started the next Kshatriya lines. So those Kshatriyas, having come from such pure background, then their rule, even the animals tried to mimic the control of the senses and proper behavior of the human beings. Like that. I think someplace where Prabhupada is talking about that the previously that the animals would have respect for humans and see them as the senior species. Like that. So, but they felt protected. They knew that they would not be dealt with improperly. Like that. Like you see, I think it's in the Bhagavatam, it's explaining about how someone is keeping an animal, but the idea is they're going to kill and eat this animal. So because they've maintained this animal, you know, for so long and all that, then when the owner comes with the knife to kill the animal at first thinks it's a joke. So they actually know what's going on. But they think it's a joke because he's always taking care, so he's just having a fun, you know, they're going to kill you and that, but he actually won't. So when they actually figure out that he is, the animal is extremely shocked. Because this person's always taken care. So that's one of the reasons that the animal slaughter is such a abomination, is because of the breakage of faith. Right? It's mentioned in the Shastra, to kill a friend is actually one of the greatest sins. You know, it's in the category of killing Brahmins. You know, it's just touch less, but it's within that category. Killing, you know, killing Brahmins, killing cows, killing friends, like that. That's it's in that category. Because of that, you know, either the elevation or that trust, it's there.
That, yes. There's a saying to take out a thorn with a thorn, or that some situation is unfavorable and there is asuric element, and sometimes you need asuric measurements to take care of that situation. But then usually afterwards, the pain is still there. Like when you take the thorn out, you get more pain. And so how can we function in this material environment, which is many times permeated by asuric principles and by rajasic and tamasic principles? It's like you can't function from a purely brahminical platform if you want to be engaged in business or in politics.
No, but that's the rule of them. That's the rule of them. So you can be purely brahminical in your following of it. You see, there's your mentality and then there's the technique used. Because it's just like I remember seeing once, there was a devotee who ran a business, a cloth business, and his, like, maybe closest friend. And the closest friend came to his shop and said, okay, I like this, how much for this? He wanted to buy some cloth. And the shop owner said, it's this much. And so then the friend, because, you know, he considered himself very expert in, you know, bargaining with businessmen and all this kind of thing. And also because it's a friend, and so he was a little bit overly, familiar. That he says, okay, I'll give you this price, which was much less. So the shop owner says, no, because you're my friend. I've already considered all these things and dropped the price down to, you know, what it costs me. I'm only charging you cost. I'm not taking any profit. And so then the friend then said, no, I don't believe it. It should only be worth this much, you know. And then the shop owner said, take it for free. Because you're my friend. I don't mind giving it to you, but I can't sell it to you for less than what it costs. If you want to buy it at cost. You know, you want it, then take it for free. I can't sell it I can't sell it for less. So then it's going on. It says, if I was being a business person, then why would I tell you the cost price? I would tell you more, and then you would bargain down, and I'd still make profit, and you'd still feel good about yourself. It says, but because you're my friend, I didn't. So that's why in business, it's called satyanrita. Means half truth, half lie. You can't tell the truth when you're dealing in business. It's just the way it works, because if you told the truth, no one will believe you. No one believes that a businessman tells the truth. It's just the way it is. So even if you told the truth, no one would believe it. You know, it's like Narad Muni and the King Cobra. When the King Cobra became a devotee, then, you know, Narad Muni's told him to, he has to be nonviolent. You know, you can't bite people and all that. So then, you know, he used to live under the bridge and all that. And then when the kids figured out that he's not going to attack them, then they were harassing and throwing stones and this and that. So then later on, Narad Muni came. And then, you know, he was asking how he's going. And then he could see he wasn't very happy. He says, what's the problem? He says, well, now that I'm nonviolent, then all the kids and everything, they you know, abuse me, you know. So Narad Muni says, no, I told you to be nonviolent. I didn't say you can't raise your hood. You know? So, in other words, it only looks like. Like I've seen so many times, like in Indian families, the little child is doing something they shouldn't be doing. So they're told nicely, they don't respond, you know, because they're so absorbed. So then they'll make some kind of noise or face, you know, but it's very, caricaturized. You know, they get angry, you know, like this, they're very, you know, don't do that, you know, like this. You know, the kid gets scared and runs off, stops doing it. And then all the adults laugh. So they weren't angry, it's just that they made the show of anger, but they weren't actually angry. You know what I'm saying? So it's not that you actually have to be angry, you know. And I've seen many who don't come from that kind of background or that samskar, they actually get angry at the child. You know, and so it has a reaction in the child. Because the other one, the child doesn't feel insecure. He just knows, I'm not supposed to do that. The other one, he knows, I'm not supposed to do that, and he feels insecure. So in dealing with these other people, you're clever. You still work according to Shastra. Your mentality is a mode of goodness because you're doing it to please Krishna. So that's there. So you're not interested in the result for yourself. But the technique that you would use, you know, that you're dealing with that element, you know, that you would use according to full diplomacy or economic, you know, understanding of whatever it takes.
In business, that's understandable, especially also if you're a devotee, because it's kind of like, okay, the customer comes, the customer buys, the customer goes. But in politics, we kind of like have to deal with people on an ongoing basis, and these people might be devotees, and diplomacy is not exactly one of the 64... qualities or items.
No, but it's one of the 64 arts.
Arts, yeah.
So, arts that Krishna and Radharani know.
But to be diplomatic.
Diplomacy. When we say someone's being diplomatic, now let us say he was representing the state. He goes to another country, and he very diplomatically presents the needs of his country in a way that the other country appreciates it and accepts it. We would call that good, because he's doing it on behalf of his country. So generally, the negative connotation of diplomatic means I'm doing it for my own purpose. So diplomacy is not the problem. Is it for sacrifice? Is it for a higher purpose of diplomacy? Or is it for your own purpose? For your own purpose, that diplomacy is not good. It may be technically correct, but no one will appreciate it. But it's being done actually because of it's the Shastric principles. There are higher principles you have to take care of. You know, you're dealing with this person, but there's a greater understanding, you know, greater community thing that has to be dealt with. So you're going to deal with the person in the context of the greater principle. That diplomacy, that's what human life means. That's etiquette. When etiquette is applied in the political field, it's called diplomacy. But otherwise, etiquette is is understanding your position, the other person's position, what it is, the work that is supposed to be on the natural relationship, what's the result, and how I should behave and speak and act, that it happens. So technically, your etiquette and your diplomacy are the same thing. It's just whether it's diplomacy is used when it is politically applied. You know, etiquette is when it's socially applied. Like that. Does that make sense? So it always comes down to what's the motive. That's the motive. Because if the motive is good, Yudhishthira Maharaj, he had his spies, he was all, you know, intrigue and everything's going on because he's dealing with elements that aren't necessarily God conscious. So you can't deal with a non-God conscious person with the same trust as you would to someone that is. Right, so that degree that one is not Krishna, to that degree one has to be diplomatic. But the point is it has to be on a higher principle. Then it's fine. That's just the way it works. Because otherwise what happens is that lack of diplomacy then doesn't give rise to less politics. It gives rise to less etiquette. So in the name of not being diplomatic, meaning that it's bad, devotees will drop all etiquette and deal very roughly with each other in the name of getting the service done. But Krishna is only interested in service that follows etiquette, really. Right? Because that means the etiquette is the whole social interaction, because only through that is rasa tasted. Because getting something efficiently done is only part of the process of rasa. Right? But the thing is if you're going to deal roughly, means you don't understand the sambandha gyan. Like that. Either you don't understand, okay, they're another member of the same group or committee or something, or administration or management, and so therefore they have to be respected because of their position. They are in a position. They have to be respected. They may be junior to you or senior, but it doesn't matter. They're still in a position. You have the element of that, you know, how you say, as a living entity, as a human being, they must be respected as a devotee or as super souls in their heart. So many aspects, whatever is one's inspiration, that one still has to follow the etiquette. There's no excuse for not following the etiquette saying, well, I was forced to, or, you know, they left me no alternative. That's all just bogus nonsense of people who don't know etiquette, can't follow etiquette, or don't even want to follow etiquette. It makes it easy to just say whatever I like and get upset and angry and emotional. That's the easy thing to do. Any 8-year-old can do that. So what makes someone an adult is that ability to control that. You know, it's just like you see, sometimes you have a child and they're able to control that very nicely. They don't respond as a child. They respond in a mature way. So that will be noted. That they're a child, but they act as if they're an adult. Like that. So in the converse, I mean, or inverse, is that if an adult acts as a child, it doesn't make him any more adult. It's actually, he's a child. Though, physically, he's an adult, so you'll accept him as an adult. It's not that the mentality is not that of children. Like that. So it has to be done very carefully. This whole pragmatic, minimalist approach actually may be great in business where you're dealing with an outside person or a hired person, but it has nothing to do with relationships. It may make money, but that's all it will make. It will not make one relationship. And money does not buy relationships. Therefore, people who act on this platform don't have relationships like that. They may get ahead, but you know, economically, but that's only considered ahead amongst the economic community. But those who are really situated in the economic community, they're religious and they have relationships. And they know business is business. So amongst friends, then they work amongst themselves, but if they're outside the community, boy, you know, they don't spare them at all. You know? Like that. So they know how to deal with both. You know. But unfortunately, if one's not coming from that kind of a background, where one has experience of the being able to, you know, be yourself and be able to perform your occupation. That's why there's ashram and varna. It's two different things. So they can't separate it. So they feel the efficiency that they'll use in varna, they can use in ashram. But it's supposed to be what makes things worth an ashram, that's what you use in varna. Technique may be different, but it's actually a mentality of ashram, that's what you're supposed to use in varna. But they'll use it the other way around. And then wonder why, you know, people are upset. Is that okay? Yes.
Maharaj, I would like to ask about this point. You mentioned the philosophical deviation versus sensual deviation. And my understanding is that in philosophical deviation, one may reach a conclusion, right or wrong, that this is his conviction, and act accordingly, thinking that he's doing the right thing, even though it may be sinful, it may be off track. Whereas in the sensual deviation, one is clear philosophically about what is right and wrong, but sometimes he may, because of sensual, you know, weak-heartedness, find himself engaging, indulging, and knowing very well that this is wrong, but not being able to help himself. So in other words, this comes under the category of committing sinful activities on the strength of the holy name.
You could call it that, but you don't necessarily. Committing sinful activities on the strength of the holy name means I'm going to commit this sinful activity, but it doesn't matter because I can chant Hare Krishna and make it go away.
Okay. Or the other offense was to maintain material attachment.
That's there, but the point is if you're not a Paramahamsa right now, you are committing that offense. If you're on the platform of Bhava, you're not committing that offense.
My question is, how is this sensual deviation less?
Because you're carried away. It means, what is more? Okay, the kid is hungry, he goes into the kitchen, he steals a cookie. Okay? The adult, he is working in the business, he knows what's going to happen, he manipulates the stock market, and he makes big profit. Right? No, he puts the kid in jail. That adult goes in jail. Right? So the point is it's the element of knowledge that actually makes it worse. Both are stealing. This one is stealing bigger, one's stealing. Now, if that adult went into the store and stole the cookie, then you might say something. Then he'll get in trouble. So it's actually, it's the element of being under the influence of knowledge. But the other one's not under the influence of knowledge. They know it's wrong, but they're under the influence of the emotions and senses. The other one is under the influence of knowledge, and he's thinking, my philosophy is correct. So, does that make sense? Because the point is the senses getting carried away, that's pretty standard. You know, so we sit down to take prasad, and do we just eat only how much we need, or we take those few extra, you know, servings more? Or so those kind of things go on. But it's still workable because you accept the principle of the senses and the sense objects, those interactions have value, but the real point is it only has value in connection to Krishna. So that can be more easily converted. But the person who has a philosophical deviation, then that won't bring him near to Krishna at all. Even if he's controlled in his senses and everything, he's very moral, he's very upstanding, he's very charitable, whatever it may be, the nice quality that you're looking for, it won't bring him any near Krishna because it has nothing to do like that. So therefore, like the sahajiyas, they are performing all the devotional activities, but because they don't actually know how to properly connect it to Krishna, therefore, that's more dangerous. Like that. Or the smartas, then that's more dangerous. Or the mayavadis, it's more dangerous. Because the point is the living entity getting out of the material world. These other things, it happens. That's why the Bhagavatam gives examples of that happening. You see examples in Bhagavatam, because that's meant for Paramahamsas, the book, of sensual deviation. And that, you know, then what happens from that. But having being a philosophical deviation, like Durvasa thinking that the yogi is higher than the devotee, you know, he's chased around the universe by Sudarshan. And only when he understands that the devotees are the highest, then he's relieved from that. And then he goes off, you know, with that commitment, he goes to Brahmaloka to all the yogis there and is explaining about Ambarish Maharaj's glories. So those will take people more away from Krishna. That's your upper sampradayas and all that. So in the other class, that'll be discussed. You know, all the different kinds of deviations that can be there, you know. So, and in the six systems. So the more philosophical or more religious, all these different things. So, because the thing is why that would naturally come in the mind is because by nature people are religious. They have to have religion. So religion means there's going to be some regulated form of the lifestyle or ritual, social interaction. And from that, then we get our artha and our kama. So if, since that is important to us, anything going wrong there means everything else will be disturbed. But liberation generally is not so much a common value. Right? So the element of the gyan is not so much the prominent element. Now when you, I say, put into it that then the other thing would be is that to catch sensual deviation, that's pretty obvious. You know, because the situations and all that, it's fairly easy to identify. Philosophical deviation, you actually have to know the philosophy to actually identify it. So that means the emphasis in the society would be on the philosophy and the culture, rather than simply on the basic ritualistic forms. But that would mean education. So that would mean Brahminical culture would have to be the prominent element. But if that's not, then it will drop down. Then if it's the Kshatriya element, then it has to be religion, there has to be dharma, people have to be doing their proper duties. So they're not going to tolerate also sensual deviation simply because it's irreligious. Right? But it's for a higher principle that everybody must be engaged in the religious process. And so then the sensual element will be dealt with actually according to how bad it is, because there's a hierarchy of sensual deviation. And according to Shastra, since it's the Shastra is the point, Shastra gives religion, Shastra must be followed. Therefore, in following Shastra, then what is the appropriate correction for a particular kind of sensual deviation will be applied, and that's all. When you drop it down into pranamoy, into the Vaishya environment, then because economics only happens if there's justice, then and ethics, all these things, then any break in ethics then makes them insecure in the realm of economics. And so, therefore, it becomes a very major thing, because now you're dealing with their, you know, morality now is dealing with their occupation. Right? It's not morality is not the occupation of Brahmins and Kshatriyas. It's part of their occupation. Like that. But for Vaishyas, it's a very major element of their occupation. Because if people aren't moral, how do I keep my money? How do I, you know, show it? I can't take my money and show it to people because they'll steal it or, you know, some other kind of things. So when there's lack of morality, then they break down, all the justice breaks down, right? Because it's somebody wants more sense gratification, therefore they'll do immoral things, and that means I lose. So for the Vaishya, it becomes much more of a prominent element. And so that culture then will overemphasize the platform of morality and make it into the all in all. But actually, it's devotion that's the all in all. And morality is an important part of it, because if one is distracted by immoral behavior, the tendency is to not be aware of spiritual behavior. Right? That's its main weakness, is that it's so attractive that it takes one away from spiritual consciousness. And the immoral element generally is not very engageable in Krishna's service. Right? So, but it can be, like the gopis, you know, it's a parakiya rasa, it's technically immoral, but it's very nicely engaged in Krishna's service. So it's not that it can't be engaged, it's just generally for us who value sense gratification over everything else, it becomes too much of a distraction. And so therefore we don't take up religion and we don't take up the dharma and moksha aspects, we just take up the artha and kama aspects. You know. Or we take up religion only because it gives artha. So then, in that case, then the morality also becomes more prominent, because we'll see that as the break in the lack of morality to be break in dharma. But it's actually break in relationship that's the problem with dharma, in dharma. You know what I'm saying? So there's a lack of discrimination there because of the mode of ignorance that is applied in the business culture. Then they become overwhelmed by this. But that's why in the Vedas there is such a strong judicial system, is because the common person can't accommodate the necessarily proper placement of moral turpitude. They can't make a distinction. So therefore, it's dealt with, you know, generally quite strongly. Only because, not that it's necessarily that way, but the person who's absorbed in it and the other persons who are observing it, to them it means something. And it's just like, the man is forced into doing things he doesn't want to do because of attachment to his family. And if he doesn't do them, something will happen to his family. Right? But if you have a man and you say, well, if you don't do this, we're going to, you know, shoot this person. I don't know who that person is. Go ahead. You know, you're not going to get the person to do anything that way. You know what I'm saying? So because morality is very important to the broad range of conditioned souls, that is the most... They actually think morality is religion or is bhakti. They can't distinguish. It's an important element of human society. But it's one of four. And of the four, two are higher than it, and only one is lower. But they can't distinguish this. So they think it's the same. Morality is spiritual. Morality is religious. No, morality is part of spiritual and religion. It's not itself religious. Because we see is that for most non-Vedic religions, or practically you say all the non-Vedic religions, it's not actually religion. It's sub-religion. Bhavishya Puran mentions that Jesus, he will practice religion, but he'll preach sub-religion. He's not preaching one's relationship with God and how to deal with that. It'll be brought in a little bit, but he's preaching be good, be nice, you know, turn the other cheek and all these things. Because the people are so engrossed in sense gratification, to bring them to the platform of pranamoy, that's a big step up. Like that. So, but for someone who's acting on the platform of religion, to overemphasize morality is a step down. Because it has to be balanced. You know, it's just like in the meal, the whole meal actually has meaning if you get the proper balance. If I, you know, cook this much rice and this much dal, we got a problem. Or the other way around. You know, so that's why it has to be balanced. And so then morality is very important, but it has its place. And the general tendency is most will overplace it because that's the view of the common person. But the devotional society is based on the Brahminical culture, which is the Vedic paradigm. And so it has to be brought more in line with the understanding of the devotional and the element of liberation and all that. Because the point is it's not as much the activity as the misunderstanding of relationships. Because the activity, if one is, let's say, centrally deviated, the problem is, let's say, okay, the central deviation is instead of eating prasad, he's eating some karmi food. So the point is not actually that the senses are engaged with the sense objects of the problem. The problem is that it's the wrong sense object. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's the difficulty. Is the principle you have to look at, the principle may not be a problem. It's the application of the principle. Right? The young boys and young girls are getting a little too close. But that kind of interaction isn't the problem. The problem is they don't have the relationship that it should be in that position. But that closeness, that kind of interaction, is not the problem. It's that they're not qualified for that, or it's not appropriate for them. It's not their dharma. It's not their austerity. So that kind of dissection of the thing, that's why only the Brahmins and Kshatriyas deal with justice. The Vaishyas and Shudras don't deal with justice. If they do, they have to deal on their level, which is basically more economic or more, you know, sensual and things like that. You know, in the village, then you have your group, your panchayat in there, and with the consensus, they'll come to some understanding. But there'll be some basic rules they should be following. But very serious justice, that only can be dealt with by Brahmins and Kshatriyas. Because the problem is if you can't analyze it to this degree, there's every chance that you'll imbalance it. And just getting it done and establishing justice isn't enough. It's how it's established. If you don't do it right, you'll actually break something. And then that reaction's got to go somewhere. And so that will go to the person who applies the justice. So if the king improperly applies justice, that injustice of improper application goes to him, and it affects him and his family and his kingdom. So that's why it's not, the pragmatic element is not enough. One has, the real pragmatism is to be able to put it very much in the context and analyze exactly what's going on and then see what is actually the problem. You know, someone's sick, he has a fever, he has a cold, he has this and that. That's not the real problem, that's the symptoms. The problem is that there's a certain bug that he's got that's come by a certain exposure or eating or something like that. So you get to the root of that. That's Ayurveda, you find what is actually wrong. There's something wrong in the diet. That causes all, you change the diet, all the symptoms go away. So that's the actual dealing with that. You know, that is how to remove the problem and actually connect that whole situation to Krishna. Right? So that's why, if it's done right, it's there. But philosophical deviation, that's really hard to deal with. Because previously, you know, Prabhupada mentions, previously someone would actually be in search of the truth. So then, if they had a wrong philosophical understanding, if they were presented with the correct, they would accept it. You know? But nowadays, much of the time, it's ego and all this. This is their identity. It's my philosophy. And so if you defeat their philosophy, you actually defeat their identity. While a real searcher, he is looking for his identity. And he's found it through this. But if you can show him there's something else, then he'll move up. You know? So like that, you see, you know, like Madhva Ramanuja, so many examples, or Lord Chaitanya. He preaches Prakashananda Saraswati, or Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. As soon as he gives that clear understanding, they immediately accept, because they're actually intelligent. Like that. But some people, you can say all you like, they'll never accept, because of their ego. So it's not actually, so that's why it's actually worse. Like that. Is that okay? Yeah. But it's not a commonly understood thing, because basically, it's a brahminical understanding. Kshatriyas, if explained to properly, can understand this. Though their tendency is also going to be, because they'll look at it from religion and dharma, that it's wrong. They're not looking at it from morality, they're looking at it from dharma. So it'll look the same as the common person. But actually, they do have the intelligence to dissect it. Common person, you know, Shudras generally can't discriminate. Vaishyas could, but whether they will, whether it's good for them economically or this or that, the tendency is they don't want it to get out of hand, so you squash it, and then it's business is good, remains good, like this. So it's a thing. If you say this to them, they'll say, no, it's wrong, but why is it wrong? It's wrong, so explain why it's wrong. Oh, it's not good. Why isn't it good? It's sinful. Why is it sinful? They can't explain any of this. That's the whole point. Why is it wrong? What is actually wrong if the person had this kind of sensual deviation? They can't. All they can do is explain it according to Upadharma. be good, be nice. That's all. Why? Because that's their background. Because to be able to say exactly what's wrong with it, then that's something else. Then you have to get down to exactly what's wrong that they can't do. It's just be good, be nice. Why should you be good, be nice? Who said be good, be nice? That's then where the real problem comes. That's where the atheism comes in. Or at best, they'll take it back to their own religion, their pre-devotional religion. You know, there's some religious sentiment. But it can be just that's their own conviction. You have to be nice, and so if you behave like this, you're not nice, therefore it's not good. But that's not good enough in the devotional community. It has to be, it's not good because Krishna doesn't like it because of this reason. It says here in Shastra, it's not done because of these reasons, because this it doesn't please Krishna. That's the reason it's bad. But if you don't get that answer, it's a non-devotional answer. It's atheism. It has nothing to do with us. You know, and for most, it's not even religious, because then they should be able to explain from Manu what's wrong. That they can't do either. So they have to take it back to their Judeo-Christian background. And from that they're going. And even that they can't explain. Very few. Because they don't know the histories. So they can't explain the example, Ezekiel, 53:22 then says this. They can't do that. So therefore, it doesn't work. So it's just sentiment that they're saying this. So what's the difference? More uplifting and more righteous sentiment than the other person's sentiment, which is more of a deviation. But technically, since they can't explain it, and therefore they won't be able to connect it to Krishna. So therefore, their application of it, justice on that will be wrong. Even if it's right, it will be wrong. It won't solve the problem. It'll still go on in the community, it'll still go on in the individuals, because they can't solve it, because they actually don't know what it is. Like that. That's the difficulty. So that's why then things have to be compared back to the Shastric element of it. Like that. Is that okay? Okay, so into that.
Om Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Śrīla Prabhupāda ki Samavita Bhaktivrinda ki Janita Gaura Premanandi. I feel so, I was saying, since rest in Krishna consciousness is very important and very helpful, and we're able to in a very inspired way do our devotional service, I feel very happy that I am able to help be of assistance in this process of allowing you to get some good rest. That way then you'll be enlivened for other aspects of Krishna consciousness during the day. Like taking a shot and like that. Sometimes if you get too tired you can't sleep, so this way then he won't be too tired that he can't sleep tonight.
And he can apply to everything.
So his rest tonight will go well, his breakfast and lunch will go nice. He always feel very inspired that I'm able to help him this way. So. You're giving me this opportunity, thank you.